good to see each and every one of you, and I'm glad you're here, and isn't it a beautiful day? The privilege that we have, as always, to gather together as God's people, to sing His praise, to be encouraged, and to encourage one another, and to live a life that honors Him. It's good to see some back that haven't been with us in a while. I know Lewis has been out, and he's wanted to be here, and he is so glad to be back, and we're grateful for that, and answers of so many prayers on your behalf, or on his behalf by you, and I appreciate that. Thank you. The passage that was read before us just a moment ago by Hunter, the man that Jesus tells about in this parable, some have called him a scoundrel. Others have said he was a rascal. Some have said they've labeled him a liar and a thief. Jesus calls him both unrighteous and shrewd, or wise, at the same time. And yet our Lord didn't always feel the need to use good people to teach lessons that he wanted to teach. As a matter of fact, on more than one occasion, he would use people that were maybe less than desirable, people that had certain things in their lives that stood out and they were not good, and yet Jesus would use them to teach something, a message he wanted to communicate with those who were listening to him on that occasion. For example, he used a greedy farmer, someone he eventually calls in the parable about him that God calls a rich fool, in order to teach a lesson about eternal preparation. He uses someone that he calls a wicked slave in order to teach the means a lesson about forgiveness over in Matthew chapter 18. He uses on another occasion a self-righteous tax collector in order to teach a lesson on humility, Luke chapter 18. And here in the parable before us today, he uses a dishonest steward, or a manager, as the New American Standard translates it, in order to teach some very important lessons to us about life and about eternity and the kingdom of God. And that's where I want us to spend our time. First of all, let's consider this parable. It's often called the parable of the unjust steward. I actually ran across one commentator that called it the parable of the prudent steward. But as you enter into this parable and as you begin to look at the verses that were read for us just a moment ago, Jesus begins by telling us about two individuals. There's a rich man. The rich man is a landowner. He is a wealthy individual. We're told that in the very beginning. And more than likely, he is an individual that was an absentee landlord. What I mean by that is he had someone else basically taking care of his affairs, but because he wasn't always there. That was not uncommon in Israel. They would oftentimes, there were those that would do just that. They would have someone else that basically they would entrust their affairs to, and that individual would take care of their estate. So enter into this story a steward, a manager. And this steward or this manager, just the very idea of that, is somebody that is trusted with another's property. This individual typically controlled the estate, especially as it had to do with the financial affairs of the estate. And this individual, these types of individuals, these men could be either slaves or they could be free persons. Either way. But they were administrators and they had full authority over everything involving the affairs of the estate. There are several others in Scripture that are mentioned as stewards or managers of that which belonged to another. One of them that you're familiar with is Eliezer. He was a steward for Abraham all those many years ago. Another one that you're familiar with is Joseph. Do you remember that when he was bought by Potiphar, and there became a servant in the house of Potiphar, the captain of the guard of Pharaoh, that it came to a point where he was entrusted with everything. He became Potiphar's steward. And as we find over in Genesis chapter 39, that Potiphar did not even concern himself with anything except the food he ate. Joseph took care of it all. The apostles, if you look in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1, Paul there refers to the apostles themselves as stewards of the mysteries of God. And then also we find that you and I, as Christians, we are, in the very next verse, he refers to us as stewards of the manifold grace of God. Not in the next verse, it's over in 1 Peter chapter 4, I'm sorry, verse 10. And then, elders, those who shepherd us, those who watch out for our souls. One of the things that Paul says as he wrote to Titus in Titus chapter 1 and verse 7 is that these men are God's stewards. They are entrusted with the care of this congregation or of any congregation depending on where they are appointed. But they are stewards, God's stewards. So here are the two individuals. Well, as we read, what happens is that there's an accusation made against this steward. The rich man receives a report that his manager is wasting or squandering his possessions. Now, we're not told who brought the charges. We don't know. But it apparently was somebody that was reliable enough for the owner, the manager, the rich man to believe it because he acted upon it. And what he does is he calls this man in. Now, this rich man is apparently respected in the community. I say that because at no point does Jesus say anything of a critical nature about this man. And if he had been a corrupt man himself, if he had been a man who had treated people unfairly, then most likely no one would have ever said a word. They would have let that steward just go on and rob him because they think, well, he's a bad man himself, so why should we take up for him? Why should we say anything to him? But it seems that he was a good man. He was a generous man. And because others saw that he was being mistreated, that his steward was taking advantage of him, they let him know. So the rich man summons his steward into him, and he asks him a question. He says, "What is this I hear about you?" He gives him an opportunity, as we would say today, to fess up. To tell the whole story. But this steward is too clever for that. And he doesn't say a word. He remains quiet. Because he really doesn't know how much the master does know. So what the master tells him is, "You're no longer going to be my steward. I want you to turn in the books. I want you to bring in the accounts." It's like a business owner today who owns a business, but he's hired somebody to manage that business. And that manager is responsible for all of the workings of that business, but that manager is, as we might say, cooking the books. He's doing some things under the table so that he actually is pocketing a certain amount of money that the owner will maybe never find out about as long as he keeps working the books to his advantage. And finally, somebody reports upon him. They tell about what he's doing, and the owner says, "You need to bring me the books. I want to see with my own eyes where the money's going. I want to see what's been going on with the income that's coming into this business." And so the steward knows that his job is over. His position for this man as the manager of his estate, of his affairs, of his financial affairs is done. So he finds himself with a dilemma. He knows he can no longer be steward, and he says that, I no longer can be steward. He says, "I'm too weak to dig." He has done this kind of work for so long that physically he can't last out in the fields digging. He says, "I can't do that. I'm too ashamed to beg. I'm not going to go out and sit somewhere by someone's gate or along a street and beg for money. I can't do that. So what am I going to do?" He comes up with his scheme, if you will. And apparently he has three options in his own mind that are available to him. One is to go work, dig. The other is to beg. The third is to do more of what he's already done. Still. And so he decides that he will summon each of the master's debtors. He will have each debtor come in to him individually, in secret. He has to do it quickly because he knows he's got to turn in the books before long. But he will have each one of them come in, sit down before him, and alter the certificate of debt that they have on the books in their own hand. Either they'll alter it or they will write out an entirely new ticket with a lesser amount because he's lessening the debt that they owe to the estate. And the purpose in all of this is so that it will work well for him. When he's fired, he'll have people that will feel, man, you help me out. Let me see what I can do for you. So he calls the first one in. And he has him sit down and he asked him, how much do you owe my master? Now he knows how much he owes. It's just business. Tell me how much you owe. He wants to see if they're on the same page as what this man believes he owes to the estate and what he's got on the books that he owes. And this man says, I owe you 100 measures of oil. He says, take your bill, sit down quickly and write out 50. He cuts the bill in half. Wouldn't you love that if somebody suddenly called you in and said, how much do you owe on your house? Well, I still owe $50,000 to the bank. Sit down real quick and make it out for $25,000. Wow, okay. So he sits down and he writes out his new bill, or he corrects this bill, and he makes it out for $50,000. This was a savings in that day and time of about 500 denarii. Well, that means probably nothing to you, but in that day and time, it was the amount that a farmhand would make in a year and a half. That's a year and a half's wages that suddenly have just been written off. Would you appreciate being able to keep an extra year and a half of your wages and not suddenly having to just pay them out to someone? Of course. So you know he's very thankful for what's just been done for him. He calls in the second man. This man's debt is in wheat. He asks him, how much do you owe? He says, 100 measures of wheat. He says, take your bill, write out 80. In other words, he gives him a 25% discount. He writes off 25% of what the debt is. And it would have been approximately, in that day and time, it is estimated about 1,000 bushels of wheat. A good amount. And as each of these debtors, there's more, we're just told about these two, but as each of these debtors goes home, what do you think they said to their families back home? You're not going to believe what happened to me today. You know, we've owed this amount to this man over here. His manager called me in today and he sat me down and he says, here, cut your bill in half. Can you believe that? We only owe half of what we used to owe him. And another man goes home. Can you believe what he did? Let me tell you, he knocked my bill. He 25% off what I owed. And this went on throughout the community. Finally, the steward turns in the books. And as the owner is going through them, he looks over the accounts. He notices the changes. He realizes that these changes have been made, but they've been made in the handwriting of the various debtors that owe this to the estate. He has two choices. Legally, because he had fired this steward, legally he can go to each one of his debtors and he can say to those debtors, listen, these reductions were not authorized by me. He had already been fired. He had no authority to act on my behalf. So you still owe the entire amount. Well, what's that going to suddenly do to his reputation in the community? Everyone's going to look at him and start to say, well, what kind of man are you to suddenly get our hopes up and allow this to happen? Now you're telling us that the original amount, we've got to go back and pay the original amount in full. You're just not very considerate, are you? Or he could simply remain quiet. He could say nothing about it. And he could pay the price of this clever steward's salvation because that's what he's just done for the steward. He has provided for him so that others will reach out to him and maybe even hire him in the future. And he could also, in so doing, enjoy his own reputation in the community because people would begin to or continue to talk about how generous of a man he is and what good fortune they've had because of his consideration. And that's the choice he made. The rich man proves himself to be generous. Now he praises the steward not because the steward is a thief and is dishonest. He praises the steward because the steward, in his shrewd thinking, is looking forward to how he's going to take care of himself in the future when he can no longer be this man's steward. That's what he's praising. And so this rich man proves himself to be generous, not because he allows what the steward has done to stand, not just because of that, but also because he simply dismissed the steward and didn't send him to jail. You see, he had every right to place this man in debtor's prison. He had every right to take him and his family and to sell them into debtor's prison and to try to recoup some of his losses. That was his right, but he chose not to do that. Instead, he maintained his generosity and the consideration that people had for him in the community by allowing what had been done by this steward to stand. And this master commended him, as I said, not for his dishonesty, but he commended him for the clever way in which he provided for his own future security. Now, what is it that we're supposed to learn from all of this? That it's okay to go out and be a false manager, to be unfaithful to your employer, to cheat, to lie, to steal? No, that's not what Jesus is drawing from all of this. And you have to read on. I know I only had Hunter go through verse 9, but verse 13 carried us through the whole thing. And there are some lessons, some very important and valuable lessons that Jesus teaches us through all of this. The first one is this. He talks about, if you'll notice in verse 8, he says, first of all, the sons of this age are more shrewd in their relation to their own generation than the sons of light. What does he mean by that? The sons of this generation are more shrewd in their relation to their own than are the sons of light, than are God's people. I think what he's saying is that the wicked of this world are better at planning for their own future than children of God are at planning for their eternal future. Folks, the people of this world will look out for their own well-being. They think about, what am I going to do? How am I going to make it in tomorrow's world? What do I need to do as far as making sure that my future is secure? But the question is, how many Christians, how many children of God spend as much time paying that kind of attention to their own eternal salvation? How many of us give attention to the things which concern our souls as much as we give attention to the things that concern our daily business affairs? How many of you have investments that every day you're checking? What's the stock market doing? How's my return on my investment? You're checking on those things. But how many of us every day are spending time in the Word of God? How many of us every day are spending time in prayer? How many of us every day are spending time looking at the things that God has placed in His Word for us to grow by and trying to live those things out in our lives and asking ourselves, am I being a faithful steward of what God has given me? Am I preparing for eternity every day of my life? You see, what he says in verse 9 is this: make friends for yourselves by means of wealth, what he calls the wealth of unrighteousness. He simply is referring to worldly wealth, what all of us have had to work for throughout our lives, worldly wealth. So that when it fails, you will be welcomed, or they will receive you into eternal dwellings. Let me share with you another passage. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, there in verse 17, Paul begins by saying, "Instruct those who are rich in this world, or in this present world." And then if you jump down to verse 18, he tells them some things. He's already told them not to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches. But then in verse 18, he tells them, instruct them to do this, to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous, ready to share, storing up for themselves a treasure of a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. Many of you, older individuals in this room, may remember the name A.M. Burton. If you don't know the name, I dare say you know the company he founded, Life and Casualty Insurance. Brother A.M. Burton was a faithful member of the Lord's body. He wasn't baptized till 1910. I think it was later than that. But for the last of his life, all through that time, he became a faithful servant of God. What you may not know about him are some of the things that he did. Central Church of Christ in downtown Nashville can contribute its construction to him and the money that he gave toward that church. Not only that, in his day and time, something that was beyond what we even see today or even think of churches doing, he established in Nashville a day home for working mothers so that they could leave their children. We call it child care today. A.M. Burton helped to establish that before it was even the popular thing to do, so that working mothers in Nashville could have a place where their children were cared for while they worked. Not only that, he also purchased a building to be used as a home for working girls who had come to Nashville from outside of the county in order to work in the large city. He purchased and even provided a home for the boys for the same purpose in Nashville. During his lifetime, he contributed over $20 million to David Lipscomb College. And as I was reading on him this past week, it was said that if he had kept everything he had ever made, the man would have had over $100 million in the dollars of his day. He was a very wealthy man. Do you know that during his golden years, he said, if the Lord can live on 90% of my income, I can live on 10. And he lived for the rest of his life on 10% of his income and gave 90% of everything he made away. I think this is what Jesus is talking about when he talks about through the faithful use of unrighteous wealth, of the mammon, the wealth of unrighteousness, using it in a way that honors God so that they will welcome you into eternal dwellings. Folks, there are going to be people in heaven that one day are going to thank A.M. Burton because of his foresight and because of his generous gifts, because they're Christians, because they were helped in their lives, because their lives were made better and they were drawn closer to Christ because he saw, here is an opportunity, God has blessed me, I have this, I need to use it for the good of others. And he did. And lives were changed because of what that man did over all those years. It was said he would pluck rosebuds and go through his office and just give them out to employees. He was just that kind of man. In his retirement years, you know, he started raising chickens again. If you went by his house, he'd give you eggs. He was just a down-home man, but he was a very wealthy down-home man. But he used what he had, what God had given him, to bless others. Another thing I think that Jesus is saying in this, and we find it in three verses, verses 10, 11, and 12, and that is that we need to be faithful in the little things of life. And young people, listen to this. If you hear nothing else in all I say today, listen to this. Because in verse 10, what Jesus says is that he who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. He who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous in also in much. Many of us growing up learned that if we handled the responsibilities we were given as a younger person in an appropriate way, then our parents would entrust us with greater responsibilities. If you don't take care of the little things, then when you ask mom and dad for the keys to the car, no, can't trust you. You don't take care of this. You don't do what I tell you to do in these other matters. How can I know that you're going to be responsible in this matter here? And when it comes to God, if God can't trust us in the little things, then how can He trust us in the great matters that He wants to lay upon us, to give to us, in order for us to accomplish His purposes? In verse 11, he says, "If you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you?" Do you realize that God allows us to use the unrighteous wealth, what we earn, what we have in this world, as a test? He allows us to use that to see whether or not we can truly be entrusted with what He calls true riches. How can He give to us and endow us with the glories of heaven if we can't be proven faithful here with the little things that He gives us now in this life? And then in verse 12, he goes on to say, "If you've not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give to you that which is your own?" Here upon this earth, you and I are in charge of that which is really not our own. You say, "It's my money, I earned it." God says, "No, it's not yours. I gave it to you. I've allowed you to have it. You're a steward. You're managing what is mine until I call you home. I'm just watching to see how you're going to handle what I've given you. I've given you wealth. I've given you intellect. I've given you I've given you so many things, but will you use them in a way that honors me?" You see, we can't, and I've said this over and over again, you've heard me say it, we can't take it with us when we die. It's only lent to us for a little while, for us to use while we live here. And when we get to heaven, then we'll be given that which is truly ours, and that which is eternal, and that which does not rust away or fade away. And when we get there, what we have as our very own will depend upon how we've handled what God has given to us here. What will God bless you with there? Because it's all dependent upon how you use what He gives you here. Then there's that last one. Verse 13. "No servant can serve two masters. He will hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other." And then he says, you cannot serve God and money. Many of us, at some time or other in our life, probably have had two jobs. We've had our full-time job and a part-time job to make ends meet. And maybe there are those of you that while you were going to college, you worked that part-time job, going to school in the day, working a part-time job for a few hours at night, coming back to the dorm or maybe home and studying, and then getting up and doing it all over again the next day. And you say, "Well, I can do that." Yes, you can do that. But you can't do what Jesus is saying. You see, during Jesus' time, a slave had no time of his own. No, every moment of his day, every ounce of his energy, all of that belonged to his master. And so he had no time which he could call his own. In the same way, folks, serving God can never be a part-time or a spare-time job. God wants all of you, or He wants none of you. He will not take leftovers. And if you're going to serve God, you've got to make sure, "I'm going to do it with all of my heart, and with all of my soul, with all of my might." Because that's what He requires. It's the way He wants us to love Him. Folks, if you're a Christian here today, do you know that there awaits you an eternal dwelling? It is the eternal dwelling of the righteous. And in that place, according to what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17, there is awaiting you an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comprehension. you can't begin to imagine what God has awaiting you there. But what awaits those who are sons of light is so far beyond our comprehension that God is watching to see how we are going to handle what He's given us here to determine what we will actually receive there. Are you a son of light? Are you a child of God? Have you been buried with Christ in baptism? If so, the question for you is, are you using what God has given you here to the fullest extent of your ability to honor and glorify Him, longing for the day when He will entrust you with true riches? Because what's here is not eternal. What's here is temporal. But what's there lasts and never wears out. But tonight, today, if you're here and you're not a child of God, you're not a Christian, you've never put Christ on in baptism, you've never obeyed the gospel, do you realize what you're forfeiting? Do you realize what you're giving up by continuing to stay where you're at? Don't do that. Today, give your life in obedient faith to Him. Confess His name before this body of Christians, be buried with Him in baptism. And know the rewards that He promises to you. Live your life serving Him all the days that He grants you. If you need to respond, we have a song. There's power in the blood. That's the only thing that can cleanse us. Nothing else. And we sing that song to invite you to come. So if you need to come this morning, won't you do so as together we stand and sing.